Safety first.
Welcome to Safety First, TÜV Süd's podcast on cybersecurity and more. I'm Schleen Schürmann, and today we're talking to Mirko Ross about the current state of the IoT. Mirko is not only an expert in cybersecurity and the Internet of Things, he also regularly hosts live talks on the topic on YouTube and is an entrepreneur himself. Welcome to our podcast, Mirko. It's great to have you here with us today.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me.
Mirko, when we talked before the show, you made a very interesting statement. You said you believed the IoT was broken. What makes you say that? It sounds pretty dramatic.
Oh, yes, it's an invisible broken situation. I think so, because everybody of us has IoT devices. And I mean, we are using these devices by a daily way, and then we see, well, there's a data breach, there's a botnet rising, there's something going wrong. We read it in the news, and luckily most of us are maybe not affected, but sometimes we don't know if we are affected. So if the device is part of a botnet, maybe my fridge is currently used to attack a nuclear plant, I don't know. And that's really a situation which is serious in the IoT. It seems to be somehow broken in security.
How often does this happen to IoT devices?
Well, if you look at the current numbers from all these monitoring services in the IoT industry, it looks rather dramatic. So there are really botnets out there with millions of devices, which are IoT devices, which have been captured and which are used for criminal activities.
You're an entrepreneur and consultant in the field of cybersecurity, and you also host regular live talks on IoT topics on YouTube. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm a nerd somehow. Like, what do you say? I'm really interested in technology since I have started my working with my first computer when I was a teenager. And even to be honest, I did also my first hacking experience on that time. But meanwhile, I have completely changed the sides from being a teenage hacker towards a serious cybersecurity consultant and expert. So I'm looking more on the other side, like what do we need to take as an action to prevent ourselves from being hacked, or what do we need to take for companies to protect their assets? But I'm still in the hacker and the hacker activism space as well. I'm talking a lot with hackers. I really know how a lot of hackers are thinking. What is their mindset? What is their attitude? So I'm still in the scene and I have a look on the scene. So I know pretty very well so what's going on in the cybersecurity space.
But you went from black hat to white hat.
To be honest, it was teenage hacking. I mean, this is like the word hacker is in the original historic phrase. It's not a negative term. A hacker was always a guy or people who are interested in having a deep look into technology. So a hacker is disassembling technology to understand technology and maybe assemble it again. So this is the purpose of hacking back to the 1960s. Now, the past 10 years, we see that hackers has become more a negative term because of all the cyber criminals who are doing the same. They are disassembling our technology, but to find vulnerabilities. So by that, I think the term hacker has become another meaning now.
Who are your customers or clients in general?
Well, we have different sets, of course, of customers. So one customers are, for example, on field of smart cities and smart buildings, because we see there's strong movement of that things are becoming smart. So things are becoming connected. Buildings are becoming connected spaces. Another part of customers are, for example, industrial customers who are in Industry 4.0. So they're connecting their shop floor. And then we have customers as well in the energy space, because energy has become also heavily connected by smart grids.
And what topics are you interested most at present?
Yes, to me, it's mostly currently the difference between software life cycles and hardware life cycles. For example, take a car. Normally, you have a car, maybe the hardware life cycle of a car is, let's say, 15 years. Or we have fans who are driving cars which are much older out there. But take software, take your iPhone. What is the software life cycle of an iPhone or smartphone? It's maybe 5 years.
Maximum 1 year?
Yes. For the sometimes it's 1 year, 2 years, but let's say maximum 5 years. So there's a difference between the software life cycle and the hardware life cycle. And now the big question is, how do we maintain this in future? Because if the software life cycle is outdated, the hardware will become vulnerable. Very extreme situation, for example, in a smart building, where the life cycle of the building is maybe 40 years. So how do we keep all the smart things really safe and secure during the life cycle of a building?
So if we come back to your sentence, the IoT is broken and all the attacks on the IoT, what are the most common attacks on the IoT?
I mean, what we see is a lot of automated attacks, and that's just rather clear because the IoT is a mass device situation. So normally you're a vendor, and if you take video cameras, connected video cameras, for example, this kind of items are shipped in hundreds of thousands or maybe a million items of products. So normally what we see is that the attacks on these items are rolled out on an automated way. So what do the attackers, what is the strategy of the attacker there? Of course, they also are normally lazy guys. They don't want to hack a set really by using the keyboards. They're just running scripts. They are scanning the networks. Oh, is there an IoT device? Then they will just try rather simply to test different ports or APIs to check, is there anything available? And then they try passwords. Is there a factory setting password available, like admin.
Yeah.
All that stuff. So, and unfortunately, they are rather successful by that strategy.
Can you give us some concrete examples?
If we look past, it was 2016 was really the example which was shaking the industry. And this example was the Mirai botnet. So the idea of the Mirai botnet was that a few guys had the idea to build up a so-called DDoS for rent weapon, which is a criminal service in the darknet where you can just rent a fleet of IoT devices to execute attacks on certain servers. And the idea is to tear down the server, and by that the service
by just stressing the system.
Exactly. And so, and this is a way of ransom the operators of the server. In this case, they were just targeting so-called Minecraft server, which are gaming server. And the gaming community is a rather, let's say, critical customer community, because if the servers are getting low or not available, the people are changing just the game provider. So they were attacking gaming servers at a first execution. And Mirai was rather successful in terms of the growth rate. So they were focusing on IP cameras, which are connected smart cameras. They were using a combination of almost 60 passwords, standard passwords, like admin 12345.
1234.
Exactly, all this classical stuff. And by that, they had been rather successful and they were getting access on the administration surface of these devices. And then they have the ability to change the software on the device by applying own patches and updates. So this was really a shake in the industry because it was showing that there are a lot of devices out there which are not secure. And it was so powerful what they have built as a botnet that even all the intelligence, all the law enforcement globally was watching on this botnet. Obviously, I think they were thinking about that this is a new cyber weapon carried out by one of the suspicious cyber weapon nations or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't been a cyber weapon. It was just a criminal botnet.
And just started by some guys from, I don't know, it was Alaska? Or?
Yeah, exactly. It was even like if you look in the press somehow, who are the bad guys in hacking? Normally you see, well, it's North Korea or whatever. No, it was not North Korea. It was even not Russia or China. These were two guys from the US. And this also shows like cybersecurity and hacking is a global challenge. Whatever nation we are looking for, whatever region we are looking for, everybody has to deal with cybersecurity. And this is really a global challenge to manage that.
So what was the outcome or the actual damage of Mirai?
It's funny. I think the original authors of Mirai, they did some damage, like successfully they did outtakes of some servers, and even they attacked a server of a very famous or popular cybersecurity editor. So, and that's maybe why they were themselves become rather successful by that attack. But what they did is, like in terms of getting themselves protected from law enforcement, they just published all the codes of Mirai in the internet, because the idea was, oh, if there will be any forensic situation and we are getting arrested and the police will look in on our computers and they will find the Mirai code, we can say, well, we just downloaded it from the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, they opened the box of Pandora, because they published a blueprint for IoT botnet, which is still a rather popular blueprint, the Mirai botnet. And we see that some other people were just taking the codes, were building up their own Mirai cloned botnets to run other attacks. So one famous attack.
So it spread itself like a virus.
Yes, it's something like a successful technology, open sourced and used by criminals. And if you look back, there was a rather big outtake of routers of the Deutsche Telekom.
Mm-hmm.
They were not primary a target for attack of the telecom. The attacker's desire was to take the routers as an asset to perform other attacks, really on another target. But they did it wrong, simply. And by that, they created that a lot of routers of the telecom and of telecom customers were not available anymore. And this was a big damage for the telecom.
What could we learn, or especially what do you learn from such attacks?
Well, what we learn is, like, as you said, the IoT is somehow broken. I think we have an industry problem yeah. out there with a lot of devices which are not secured. Because Mirai was a rather simple attack. It was just a so-called brute force attack where you try to find out, is there an administration panel and can you log in with a password combination? So one result of it is that now some regulation is stepping into force. Like, for example, in the US, we have the California Cybersecurity Bill, where you now is one restriction for IoT vendors that they need to implement a situation where you need to change your passwords on IoT devices. If you take it into operation, you have to change your passwords. And we see, well, like this is a rather simple thing, forcing people to change the password. On the other side, a lot of IoT vendors are even not doing that. And by that, we have still a lot of vulnerable devices out there. There currently, when we have this nice podcast talk, there will be maybe thousands of devices shipped which are unsecured. I mean, this is not a good situation. And if we look like what needs to change is that the industry needs to be more aware of what they are doing. And we need better incentives for vendors to make their products safe and secure. And now we can talk a little bit, what can be incentives for vendors?
So as you said, hacks like Mirai have already led to stricter legislation. But do you think this is an effective approach to preventing cyber attacks on the IoT? Or would you prefer another way of tackling the issue? And what would that look like?
Regulation is important. Really, it's really one key asset. Because by regulation, we are getting standards, we are setting standards. And it means, what is a standard for a secure device? Even it forces vendor to implement some certain procedures. What is needed, let's say, like, do we need to make a security audit of our device? Do we need to make a proper documentation? As a vendor, are we forced really to make a security assessment of the whole IoT stack? This is not only the device, it's also the cloud service or the app which are included. So I think this is rather important. I know that this is an obstacle for certain players, because, I mean, you need to take more effort and resources in securing your devices. But on the other hand, I mean, this problem of unsecured devices is not only a problem of a single vendor, it's getting a social problem and it's getting an economic problem. So by that, regulation is rather important.
So it's also a question of transparency. How could this security label look like?
It's a good question, because it's not an easy question. Normally, I think we have to make a difference between consumer products and, let's say, industrial products. On the industrial side, it's a lot about supply chain and how security is defined in the supply chain. And one incentive there is, for example, that you are getting a selected supplier for a certain industrial component because you are fulfilling all the security standards which have been defined by the purchasing industrial company. That's one incentive. So you're getting a more exclusive supplier because you fulfill certain standards. The second one is, I think, like if you look at the consumer products, the decision is still done on the shelf. So I'm a consumer. I stand in front of a shelf of some products. So how do I decide if I buy this product? Normally, it's a question of the branding, for example, and it's a question of price. If the cheapest product with the lowest security has still an advantage, we are on the wrong track, I believe. So nothing will change. But for example, if we get a security label where it's printed on the device, yes, this device will be supplied the next 5 years with updates and patches, or this device is using, let's say, privacy critical components like cameras, microphones, and cloud services. I mean, if you have this information on a label as a consumer, you can decide more independently of what type of security you are choosing. And you're getting a little bit more aware of the impacts of buying products with low security.
So it's a little like a TÜV badge on our car.
No, it's not the same. I think it's like an energy label. So on the energy label, you can see clearly, is this product, for example, has it a high energy efficiency or has it a low energy balance? And you can do the same for an IoT product. A simple indication like, is this product sensitive in terms of privacy and security? High or low, like if there is a microphone on it or a video camera on it, I think it's a high private sensitive product. And then the question like, how long are updates and patches supplied for that product? And this is, I think, a lot of information where you can do the right pick on the shelf.
How reliable can this be? I mean, the next patch of the same device can ruin everything and make it insecure again.
Yes, sure. And that's, I think, where it steps in that you need the processes in behind as a vendor. Like, okay, if I do this, if I'm a responsible vendor and I want to label my product as a high, let's say, secure product, then you need the processes in behind. So you need the audits in behind. You need to be sure that everything in the supply, software supply chain is working right, that there are penetration tests done for this kind of products and stuff like that. I mean, of course, this will lead into better secure products. And of course, these products can be on a higher price.
But would you say as a consumer, should we show more interest in this topic or is it just too complex for us to understand? So maybe just leave it.
No, we should not resign. Resign is the wrong strategy. Mm-hmm. Of course, we need a better awareness on cybersecurity. The burden is not only on the industry side. The burden is, of course, as well on the consumer, because we as a consumer can decide what kind of products we are buying. Obviously, for smart products, it's not so easy to have a look in the behind of security, because security is not visible normally. So by that, we need this kind of transparency from the industry. But if everything is coming together, like transparency from the industry, more awareness from the consumer side, we are getting on a level of better security for sure.
So thank you, Mirko, for this interview. It was great to have you here.
Thanks for inviting me, and it was a good talk. Thank you very much.
You can find more episodes of Safety First on our website, tuvsud.com/podcast. You can also subscribe to Safety First on many audio platforms and with all podcatchers. We're also happy if you leave a review for us. Thanks for listening, and of course, stay well and safe. Safety First is produced by TÜV Süd. Editorial support and audio production by Ikone Media.